This is the Olympic Files, and I am Al.
I'm Theo.
And Eric, are you out there?
Yes, I am here.
It is Eric the Blacksmith, a New Englander, who is going to share with us something that I think has caught his fancy to a certain degree. Apparently, you've been pretty much impressed by, is it Parenti's book?
Yeah, Michael Parenti. Born in 1933, and by the way, hey Al, hey Theo, it's good to be on again. He's an American political scientist, he's still around, historian, cultural critic, he writes on scholarly, popular subjects. And I did mention this book the last time. He's written 23 of them, a PhD in poli-sci from Yale, and he wrote The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And he's covered quite a wide range of subjects, you know, U.S. politics, ideology, imperialism, democratic socialism, religion, ancient history, pretty much all the basic food groups, and then a few more on top of that. And he wrote a book called Democracy for the Few. And he really puts our culture in the United States and the glories of capitalism, I'll put that phrase in quotes, under a pretty high-powered microscope. And his rationale is almost the same as if you had a friend with halitosis or, say, a piece of food on his chin, would you tell him? You know, that old ad, your best friend should tell thee. And his feeling is, well, we have some problems here. Maybe if we shine some light on them, we can fix them. Now, Parenti, he ran in Vermont. He was on the Liberty Union Party ticket and received 7% of the vote. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a Liberty Union Party.
There probably isn't anymore.
Probably not. It was like a Connecticut party when Lowell Weicker was actually governor back in the 90s. And he railroaded through an income tax. He needed 20% of the vote to keep the party alive. Guess what? He got 19% of the vote. His party did, so it's gone. He was on Project Censored for 12 years, and he makes some very interesting points. And there is a chapter in the book that's called A Constitution for the Few. And he really, it's a very brief chapter, but it's packed with some very good points, a lot of good information. And the early American society, you know, we've heard it described as, what, egalitarian, free from the extremes of want and wealth that, I guess, labeled Europe. And if you look at the demographics and just how the moneyed interests controlled things from the colonial times onward, you got these men of influence. They actually got some pretty heavy land grants from the crown, and they were ruling, you know, lord and master over states that were quite impressive. In fact, what is it, 1700, three-fourths of the acreage in New York belonged to fewer than a dozen persons. In the interior of Virginia, seven individuals owned over 1.7 million acres. And by 1760, fewer than 500 men in five colonial cities controlled most of the commerce, shipping, banking, mining, and manufacturing on the eastern seaboard. So basically, all the stuff we've heard about, you know, the huddled masses and everything else, especially when I get into the Whiskey Rebellion later on, it was anything but the huddled masses. When actually some of the behavior of George Washington himself towards squatters in Pennsylvania acreage, his behavior was anything but egalitarian. And his administration actually practiced some very underhanded, rotten techniques that could almost be described as, what's the word I'm looking for? Inquisitionary, if that's even a word.
We like that.
Okay, it'll work. But, okay, yeah, we've had it very good in this country. There's no two ways about it. But I think we need to look at the myths we've been fed, and I've looked into this more, and the more I've learned about Washington and Hamilton, I mean, I dislike Hamilton, Al, like you dislike Jefferson.
Okay.
And any respect that I had for George Washington pretty much vanished with this latest spate of digging into some of this history.
I'll take Washington if we're all going to pick one to dislike the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, now in 12 of the 13 states, I guess Pennsylvania was the only one, property-owning white males could vote, not more than 10% of the total adult population. So, of course, the indigenous folks, they were, you know, they were told to basically wait outside. Persons of African descent, women, indentured servants, white males lacking sufficient property. You could be white as a sheet of paper if you didn't have, if you didn't have the property, forget it. The qualifications, they were so steep, you couldn't even get in the door. You know, it's just like Carlin's line, it's a big club, and these guys weren't in it.
Yeah.
Member of the New Jersey legislature? Well, you had to be worth at least £1,000. Okay, South Carolina, state senators, you had to possess estates worth at least £7,000 clear of debt. And back in 1997 or 6, that was about the same as $1 million. So, candidate for governor in Maryland? Well, you had to have property worth at least £5,000. So, and there was no real secret ballots, and, you know, your candidates, you've got, you know, idiot one, idiot two, so you're going to have so much apathy that a lot of folks are just going to say, screw it, I'm not even going to be bothered. And, of course, you know, the people, they were pretty restive. They had an insurgent spirit. And in 1787, Mr. Washington wrote to a former comrade-in-arms, quote, there are combustibles in every state to which a spark might set fire. So these guys, you know, I think they were certainly fearful of the people, and I think more importantly, they held the working populace really an unbridled contempt. You know, they were portrayed as spendthrifts who never paid their debts, who advocated inflated paper money. And a lot of the historians today, they don't really tell too much about the plight of the common folks. You know, and so, and who were the population? Your poor freeholders, tenants, indentured hands. You know, if you wanted passage, you basically worked for, say, a farmer or, you know, rich gentry, and you'd be, say, on the land for 3-5 years. I'm not exactly sure what the time periods were, but you were truly in debt, and families would be, you know, basically kept until they worked that off.
Well, also remember, and I know that this is a bullet point we may or may not reach today, but since you listed it, the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yes.
But also before that, you had, and we kind of mentioned this before, and I mentioned it with JQ, you had Shays Rebellion, and that was prompted by a lot of these former soldiers who had gone back to their farms and were trying to get them back up again. And the first thing that happened is they were hit with higher taxes. And they're like, look, let me get this farm going. And then talk to me then, all right? Don't do this to me now. And they got PO'd, and they went ahead, and they went after not only the officials but the judges, which is a really good idea. So, I mean, when you say that there wasn't much said about the common people, it's because nobody really wants to tell that story about this supposedly wonderful new republic where, for the most part, you know, it's the old story. You know, new boss, same as the old boss. And one other thing, too, remember that the Constitution did not want to even allow You know, I mean, tell me if I got this straight, Theo, also. But if I'm not mistaken, the Constitution didn't even really want to allow not only minorities and women from not voting, but even white men who didn't have enough property.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is that all about? Is this supposed to be a representative democracy and all this crap we hear about?
You know, I always find myself having to cite this guy. I'm coming to believe he's the number one historian America has ever produced. But if everything you just said, Al, and everything you were just talking about prior to that, Eric, the first two or three chapters of the history of the Supreme Court of the United States, Gustavus Myers goes into almost painstaking detail about that, that the plight of the common man and the real cause of the revolution, what the rich people really wanted and how they manipulated the masses to start that war and why, and also the indenture, the real nature of indentured servitude. That's Myers covers that in the first three chapters. I had never read such an intimate portrait of indentured servitude before. And it's all, he's just talking about the colonies, that's it. Pretty brutal.
And I'll bet a lot of these books are out of print now, too.
Gus Myers, yeah, I think he is out of print, or most of his stuff is. Yeah, I think that it's available online, but they're hard to find.
Well,
the thing about that guy, wherever you read, and you've come across this, Al, anybody, and any mainstream source, usually they ignore Myers, but if they quote Myers or refer to Myers at all, they will always include this little jibe about how his tone was too critical. He was too critical of the oligarchs, the super rich. But you know what they never criticize Myers for? His facts. Never.
Well, isn't that the
similar to Beard's book?
Charles Beard's book?
Yes.
But I mean,
the one that Taft was banging on back in 1913, Economic Interpretation of the Constitution.
But I mean, what did I just get done sharing with you folks before we went on air? And it goes back to this far, that they won't hit you on the facts, but they'll find something to try to discredit you, like, oh, you know, you didn't dot that I, you didn't cross that T, just to do anything to besmirch whatever you're doing. I mean, it's the world's oldest ploy. You know, as I share with you guys, I mean, it's no big surprise that it happens to this very day, and I mean this very day. And I just look at them, and it's like, you know, attack the information, man. Don't attack me. I mean,
but you know what's so disheartening, Al, is the effectiveness of that ploy.
Well, what does that tell you about the mental incapacity of
Bingo.
Most of our fellow citizens?
Yep.
Volumes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like, you people, I won't go into what we had said, but here's the point. It's like, do you really mean to tell me, folks, that you don't think at several times in your lifetime you have been lied to by the media, that your government hasn't lied to you repeatedly, that they're not sticking up your rear end right now and breaking it off? You really believe that? You really believe that it only happens to other people in other countries and it never happens here? Holy mackerel. Yes, sick Heil, baby.
And the whole thing about propagandized into believing we can't be propagandized.
No, we're too smart. We listen to MSNBC, so we know what's going on.
Or,
cool.
You got the NPR clones who were really...
They really get it because they're not sponsored at all by any corporations.
Try Lockheed Martin and...
Oh,
no, they just have underwriters.
Tanks. Christmas, so, that's the worst. Yeah, Amy Goodman can do a story now in TWA 800 because they said they could. You know, where
yeah, they won't touch 9/11, though.
Oh, no, she won't. But I just had a laugh, though, you know, because what did I do that back in 2003 in March? Thank you.
I have a very brief story to share about this, the 800 story. I had written an article for the Hartford Courant back around 99, 2000. It appeared in the Hartford Courant, and I think WorldNet Daily picked it up for a short time. And a local public access TV host called me and wanted me to come on his show. You know, and he asked me, you know, your name and all this. And I said, yeah, you wrote this letter. And I said, yeah. He said, would you be interested in coming on my show? And I said, yes. And he asked me, have you written other letters to the New London Day? I said, yeah, I have. Well, a number of those letters have talked about the Kaffirs. And it's funny how I have not heard anything from this guy since that.
Let's tell the folks that what you're talking about is, what is it, a confidential annual final...
The Comprehensive Annual Financial Report,
right.
Which basically has been a creature since 1946, and it's the holy grail of accounting. A well-known individual by the name of Walter Burian sort of stumbled across this, or at least made it very public. And it's an account of everything that a governmental entity has, from soup to nuts,
yeah.
The whole shoot and match, pick your cliche. It's gross receipts, net worth, not just the budget, which is the operating expenses, but the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, has to be compiled and published by every governmental entity in this country.
But
counties, states, towns, cities. I have spoken to I've written letters to the editor about it. They have been good enough to publish them. I've gotten on the local radio talk show about it. I have spoken on air about it. I've talked to my local politicians about it. I've basically talked this up six ways to Sunday. Nothing.
Well, not even that, but I mean,
crickets.
You've not been able to get a CAFR, from any of the government entities?
Well, I haven't been able to get one from my local town.
Okay.
The state ones are online, but I think they've been tweaked. As time has gone on, since these were first exposed, the older ones, I think, are a lot more transparent. The more recent ones have had creative accounting practiced on them. So you really have to look deeply into them. If you're able to get one, look maybe two-thirds of the way down, because that'll give you the bottom line. But the bottom line here as well is these governmental entities have taken the money of the taxpayers and they've invested it in stocks, bonds, municipal funds, advance and forward insurance accounts, all kinds of different little economic goodies. And in many cases, when they say they're broke, well, they're full of crap. Now, I can't really speak to today because they've probably invested so much in these derivatives, so maybe they have lost their shirts. But the bottom line is they've sold the people a bill of goods, people buy it hook, line, and sinker, and anytime they think that their government could actually do something to screw them over, they get that 3,000-yard look in their eye, they put their finger in their ear, fingers in their ears, plural, and basically they just want to go, la, 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 I don't want to hear this.
But the whole idea of government, supposedly, as we were told, was to have some kind of transparency. And here where you have a situation where all you have to do is make the annual financial report available. And yes, it could be cooked. I mean, there's not two ways about it. But, I mean, it you can't do it. And I told you the story down here when I was talking to a lawyer from another town, and I asked him about
yes.
this. You know, and he said to me, he goes, yeah, you're right. And then the next thing he said, but try to get one. And he didn't even, you know, it was like he just knew the nature of the beast. And I don't use that too figuratively. And so the point is, it's like, where's the transparency? And the point is, well, there is none. And it's rightfully stated. If you're an incorporated community or whatever type of, you know, county or whatever, you've got a financial report. You've got, you know, the final bottom line. And I'll get... Theo, going on this one, for the 501c3 church my in-laws go to, I'm like, you know, do you ever see like an annual financial report? Why not? You see budgets right at the beginning, but you never see anything else. How come? You know, what are we going to do? Say like, well, you know, because he serves Jesus? Yeah, think again. I mean, how many thousands of dollars are you making exactly? So that's another thing I have to laugh at. You know, where's the transparency? In fact, their church doesn't even post they're not bound to. A 501c3 doesn't have to, but usually you do it, you know, just to kind of like have this somewhat of a transparency. They don't even put that one up.
Well, one thing I got from talking to Walter Berian years ago, and Al, I know you spoke with him also.
Sometimes, I've spoken with him as well.
Okay. Well, sometimes you can get a form of annual financial report from these entities, but you will never get the comprehensive report.
That's correct.
All right, so they're showing you one set of books.
Yeah. And,
okay. Now.
And you know, Theo and Al, I've thought about this as well. It's just like the Avalon Project. They put the information out there. It's available. But because the local talking heads don't talk about it, as Walter has said, and I'll quote his words on this, not a peep, not a word, not a mention, everybody just kind of sloughs it off and ignores it. And it's interesting because there's a line by Parenti here where he says, reporters often exercise, let me back up here. It says, with respect to the U.S. media, Parenti has maintained that while news coverage can be marred by problems of deadline, space, and ordinary human error, much of the misleading coverage is a result of carefully honed ideological production. Reporters, he says, often exercise such much skill to avoid the more important points of a story or news analysis, so as not to offend anyone who wields substantial political and economic power, including their own bosses and corporate advertisers. Parenti concludes that their goal is to avoid fishing too deeply into troubled waters, thereby maintaining an appearance of objectivity and moderation. Their careers, he suggests, depend in part upon their ability to equate centrist views with, quote, objectivity, unquote, and to stay within the prevailing ideological orthodoxy. Now, Al, I remembered the interview you did with a young lady into the buzzsaw that speaks to that beautifully.
Yeah, Borgeson.
Christina Borgeson.
Okay, that's who that is.
And I, not to go down this other side road, but I'll also tell the two of you that I was not impressed with her, I guess, anger or lack thereof of what exactly is going on in this country and in D.C. In other words, she got obviously wrongly dismissed by CBS and 60 Minutes in particular for that TWA 800, but there was like, she still kind of like is in a system in a sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, she was optimistic. She thought, we'll turn a corner and we'll get our rights back. It's that mentality again.
And
she sort of poo-pooed a lot of things that she shouldn't have poo-pooed.
Well, I got a chance to speak to her a few years later when I was holding down the fort at the radio stations here who were repeating a show out of Sarasota, and she was on there, and they knew that I had already spoken to her, so they would let me come on. I mean, I was like a third wheel, but they let me come in, and we talked then, and I still had a laugh, you know. She still thinks the CFR is okay and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, but she got the goods on what happened there. She was wrongly dismissed, and that should speak volumes. But I think also that she had wanted to go back in one day and didn't want to create too much of a fuss. So she let other people complain about what was going on. And I think one of the most telling stories in that book, Into the Buzzsaw, wasn't Gary Webb and his stories for the San Jose Mercury about drug dealing in that?
Oh, was that in there?
And boy, did he get suicided.
That is one hell of a book. Woo. Dark Alliance. Wow.
Yeah.
I haven't read it. Amazing. Oh, man. It's an amazing book.
And I hate to say it, but and there was something that happened down here, and I won't get specific about it. But when it comes to dealing with drugs and, shall we say, certain high-profile entities like law enforcement that may be involved, I'll tell you what. You better have terminal cancer or something like that when you do the story because you're not going to survive it. You know, nobody got whacked down here, but somebody came up to me and said, do you think it's worth doing a story? And I said to him, how long do you want to live? You know?
Drugs are the biggest and tightest ring in crime.
And I want to tell you guys, you know, I lived in New York. I knew some wise guys. Stuff happened. But down here in the South, it doesn't get any worse.
Dixie Mafia.
You better believe it, man.
Well, look what Clinton was able to pull off while he was governor.
Also, that kind of, that's right, and that kind of thing was also chronicled in the, what is it, the Bluegrass Conspiracy.
About the Arkansas flu.
And this way, this was in Kentucky. Yeah, so, I mean, it, all this stuff goes on. But I don't want to run too far afield, but I want to get back to what you were saying as well. One question I do have about Pereni, I mean, I'm not going to indict someone for this, but does he also suffer from these blinders that, I mean, when somebody's going to run for office, you tell me right away you think that it's a fair deal, I mean, that it's not a rigged deal. You know what I mean? So does Pereni look at history across his lifetime as kind of like the real story, or does he understand that even to this day, the fix has been in?
I get the impression that he really does believe that the fix has been in.
Okay.
I think my impression is, to some extent, he might have believed that a while ago, that you know, that the game isn't rigged, but my impression is that he basically got hit by enough buses to realize that the fix is in. Especially after he ran, you know, in 74. That's when he ran in Vermont.
Now, please just refresh my memory. Is he also the author of Democracy for the Few?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's the book that I'm dealing with now, and that's the Democracy for the Few, and it's his most influential book. And this is the chapter from that book, A Constitution for the
All right,
Few.
All right, I get it now.
That I'm reading from.
All right, I got it now. I thought they were two separate. I'm sorry, Eric. I thought they were two separate books. So, okay.
That's okay.
I appreciate you saying
because
that.
The two titles are so similar.
No, it's that the mind is a terrible thing to lose. So, as Dan Quayle said,
a terrible thing to mind.
Do you remember when Quayle said that?
Yeah, I think so.
Theo, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I don't remember the exact quote. It was pretty embarrassing.
Well, the quote was, the mind's a terrible thing to waste. And I think that the NAACP came out with that. Okay? The mind's a terrible thing to waste, which means that you don't want to let, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, right? And then Quayle comes out and he says, oh, the mind's a terrible thing to lose.
Yeah, that's what it was. Was it?
What a jerk.
Hey, Quayle got sick, don't you?
Huh?
It used to mystify me why Daddy Bush picked Quayle. Did you ever come across any reasons why? I finally came across a probable, at least one main reason why. Did you ever wonder why he picked Quayle?
Because his last name is that of a bird. Okay, and I don't know.
I have no idea either, to be honest, Theo.
Well, right around that time, right during that election, a new drug was coming out that in the ensuing years was going to take off and really make a ton of money for the giant pharmaceutical called Eli Lilly.
Okay.
That drug was Prozac, and can you guess where Eli Lilly was headquarters?
California?
Indianapolis.
Oh, that's right. He was from Indiana. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's
okay.
Right.
Yeah, apparently Quayle had a big hand in helping make straight the path for that pharmaceutical and that drug.
Oh, I'm sorry I said California. I was thinking of Tunney, who was very...
Oh, I remember him.
He was
okay.
I mean, they were kind of like youngish, good-looking guys, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, he was supposedly the subject upon which they based the movie with Robert Redford called The Candidate.
Okay.
But, yeah, that's right. Quayle was from Indiana.
Bill McKay, The Better Way.
That's right. Remember when Peter Boyle, who's his campaign manager, gets mad at him because Redford really wants it, or McKay wants to tell the truth? And then Peter Boyle writes something on a matchbook, slides it across the table and says, he goes, if you want to tell the truth, here's your guarantee. He opens up the matchbook and it says, you lose.
So, that's right.
So, yeah, that was interesting. But, yeah, The Candidate, I mean, that told a lot of things, too, you know. Another one of those great movies from the early 70s. So anyway, getting back to Perenni, sorry for the digression, but you want to pick it up where you left off as far as what he was picking up from that time when,
sure,
this, you know, the states had just been conceived.
Yeah. The small farmers, here you've got a lot of small farmers, you know, burdened by heavy rents. The taxes were killers, and the low income. And, okay, what are they going to, what's, if you're a small farmer, what are you going to do? You're going to try to borrow some money. Well, here comes the local loan shark, in essence, with loans anywhere, and the interest rates on many of the debts range from 25 to 40% at the time. Now, they had to mortgage their future crops, and they went still deeper into debt, and they got caught in that cycle of indebtedness that still you see today amongst agrarian people in this country and others. And no property was exempt from seizure at the time, you know, except the clothes on a debtor's back. Now, you know, and in a future show, I wouldn't mind discussing Shay's Rebellion, which was in the winter of 1787. This is when debtor farmers in Western Mass, led by Daniel Shay, they took up arms, and their rebellion was forcibly put down by the state militia. Okay, and there were some interesting anti-federalist papers that spoke to a standing army. And there is one. Let me see if I can find it here. It was number 24, Objections to a Standing Army. This one was written by Brutus. This was the ninth letter of Brutus, which appeared in the New York Journal, January 17th of 1788. And I'll read a little bit from it. Quote, "It is admitted, then, that a standing army in time of peace is an evil. I ask, then, why should this government be authorized to do evil? If the principles and habits of the people of this country are opposed to standing armies in time of peace, if they do not contribute to the public good, but would endanger the public liberty and happiness, why should the government be vested with the power? No reason can be given why rulers should be authorized to do what, if done, would oppose the principles and habits of the people and endanger the public safety. But there is every reason in the world that they should be prohibited from the exercise of such a power. But this author supposes that no danger is to be apprehended from the exercise of this power, because if armies are kept up, it will be by the people themselves, and therefore to provide against it would be as absurd as for a man to, quote, pass a law in his family that no troops should be quartered in his family by his consent, unquote. This reasoning supposes that the general government is to be exercised by the people of America themselves. But such an idea is groundless and absurd. There is surely a distinction between the people and their rulers, even when the latter are representatives of the former. They certainly are not identically the same, and it cannot be disputed, but it may and often does happen that they do not possess the same sentiments or pursue the same interests. I think I have shown in a previous paper that as this government is constructed, there is little reason to expect that the interests of the people and their rulers will be the same," unquote. And this speaks precisely to what happened in the Whiskey Rebellion, when Washington and Hamilton actually sent troops west, probably 10,000 to 12,000 militia, in August of 1794 to quell the rebellion. And this is when the judicial actually went out with the executive, in essence. And I theorized, I really need to do more research into this, that one of the reasons, the possible reasons for the sentiment against lawyers and men of title could have been the fallout from the stanching of the Whiskey Rebellion, because it was more than just excise taxes. I think there were people that were upset about the districts created in 1791, and this movement was spreading throughout the country. And, of course, in Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, that was the western frontier at the time, pretty much.
But we see here, and in Shays, I mean, wouldn't you have the common sense to give it, to just let, you know, go easy on everyone as they're coming back and trying to get their farm started again? I mean, what is it to you if you just give them some time? Or is it this desire to go ahead and foreclose on them, grab the land? And, of course, you have to have that kind of mentality to do that because you just can't care about regular people. And my point in all this, and also in the Whiskey Rebellion, the things that came down after that, really what you have no matter what, you can call your government whatever you want. You want to call it democracy? Ah, piss on that. You want to call it this? You want to call it that? You know what you got? You got an oligarchy, whether you like it or not. And that's what it is. You got a bunch of rich people, whether they run for office or not. And we always forget this one thing, too. Oh, we vote for the president. Big freaking deal. Who comes with the president but an entire body of unelected people?
And Cato spoke to that in a couple of his papers as well, where you have the president and you've got basically, you know, a dozen pieces of baggage along with him, like you said, Al, his cabinet.
Right. And when you look at it,
like,
I'm sorry, Eric, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. It was just like an Indian friend I work with used to say, you buy one, you buy all ten.
Yeah,
you know, joking around. And that's kind of what happens here.
Yeah, with one you get 12 egg roll.
That's right.
It is. And, I mean, if you look at Reagan, I mean, I love the fact of how they remember Reagan. I mean, Reagan didn't even know where he was. But, I mean, his cabinet.
Cue cards.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, if he was lucid that day, I mean, the guy was tremendous. It was just, you got to catch him on a day when he's awake.
Exactly, but, and I have to agree with what you have said about after Bush Sr. tried to take him out, and he dodged a bullet, quite literally.
Oh, yeah.
He was pretty much a rogue agent, and he says, all right, you douchebags, I'm going to screw you today, and you ain't going to be able to do squat.
Anything about you can't try to kill me again.
That's right.
I know, but when you look at if you remember his cabinet, I mean, how many of them had to get out of Dodge? Meese had to take a powder, James Watt? They had some other woman in there who was, not some other woman, I mean, a woman, and I forget her name, and she had to go. I mean, that was the most corrupt cabinet there has been, I don't know how long, you know, but that's the point. I mean, you take a look when Trub Bush was in, I mean, could you find two more nasty-ass people in the world besides Cheney and Rumsfeld?
I mean, Satan's spawn, I mean...
Rumsfeld, by the year, started to look more and more like Himmler. I swear he did.
You know, I don't know where I would go to check this out, but remember we were talking about the book, the Emanuel Josephson book,
mm-hmm.
and the Delano Roosevelt dynasty?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how or where I would...
What do you want to do? What are you trying to do? Check the Delano bloodline or what?
Yeah, well, the name Cheney came up in that book. Like, I'm talking early or mid-1800s, there was the Cheneys, and it was spelled the same as Dick Cheney, and that was one family within that dynasty. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, is that traced to Dick? Because then you see them covering their bases and still maintaining this dynasty to this day, if that's still the case.
That's
a very good question, Theo.
You know what? It's one of these things where it's probably not a coincidence, but you got to go check it out and make sure. But,
yeah.
I mean, does it surprise us? I mean, all these cats go back to basically the same bloodlines out of England. I mean, how many Norwegians do you see or Germans in this, you know? It all goes back to the motherland. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, and many times you'll see these news reports where you'll see that, you know, Colin Powell was a seventh cousin twice removed of George W. Bush. And Obama was, say, you know, third cousin thrice removed from Dick Cheney. You know, I mean, I'm sort of, you know, tossing the clinker around here, but generally they're all related. Yeah, it's one big happy family.
Yeah, and the other thing is, too, and you'll have to check this out, but usually whoever gives the keynote speech of the party at that particular presidential convention, you know, Republican Democratic convention, usually 4 years later will be the next candidate.
It's a good observation. That's more often than not, that's been the case.
Yeah, Vlade's a little sketchy, but I believe Obama was a keynote speaker. And I'm sorry, the keynote speaker is the thing. Whoever gives a keynote speech usually becomes the candidate for, in four more years. And they use it as a little bit of a test balloon to see how that goes.
Yeah, it worked for Clinton, too. That's right.
Yeah, now, also, that candidate may also lose. I mean, the keynote speaker may lose, but it's still a keynote speaker that's going to be the standard bearer for that party 4 years later. And so I think there's a lot to say about using that platform, if you will. You know, of course, that's a great word during that convention. And if it doesn't work out well, they disappear. So
don't they always go and visit the Bilderbergers before? Not that the Bilderbergers are on top. There's a pattern there also.
I don't know, but Eric, you say yes?
I think there is.
Okay.
I think the Bilderbergers, they're pretty much running dogs.
Look, but there is nothing stranger than what Obama did before he obviously was elected. That European trip, somebody explain it to me. I mean, why are you visiting Europe when you don't even know, quote, you don't even know, whether or not you're going to get, you're going to win the presidency?
Yeah, there you go.
God, he goes to like these, what, somewhat occult high places over there, and I'm sure he stopped in to see, who was it at that time? JP2, I think it was.
Well, that's the other one they got to see.
Yeah, they got to go kiss the ring.
That's right.
Who is it? Somebody sent around, was it UL? Somebody sent around a pretty recent picture of Jeb Bush going and kissing the toe ring there.
Oh, no, I didn't. If I didn't send that one, I'd remember. Really?
Oh. Yeah, there's one online, Jeb down on his knees.
I can hardly...
It might have been Liam.
Huh?
It might have been Liam.
It could be, yeah. That sounds like Liam's work, yeah.
Yeah.
I can hardly wait for 2016. I don't even think I'll be alive for this one.
I got a bet going with my mainstream historian friends. I told them, it's a $20 bet with a couple of them. I said it's going to be Jeb. And if it's not... If it's anybody else but Jeb, I'll give you $20. We'll see. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, I mean,
hope so too. Jeb and Hillary, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's what it'll come down to. That's what even they mentioned Hillary.
All right, if that's the case, then you're going to see one of the biggest massacres of a Democratic candidate dating back to Goldwater.
I agree.
Getting absolutely trashed by Lyndon.
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, no. I mean, if she goes, are you kidding me? It's going to be over in 30 minutes.
Bilingual Jeb's going to get the Latino vote.
Big time.
He's going to get the Roman vote.
Well, yep. There you go. And now you wonder why we had the illegal immigration. Well, there it is. So, all right.
Birth and fortune. And, you know, the persons of birth and fortune should control the affairs of the nation and check the, quote, leveling impulses, unquote, of the propertyless multitude who composed the majority faction, as they believe it. Now I'm going to go to James Madison in Federalist Number 10. Okay. And he says, quote, at the same time preserve the spirit and form of popular government is then the great object to which our inquiries are directed, unquote. Here, Madison touched the heart of the matter, how to keep the form and appearance of popular government with only a minimum of the substance, how to construct a government that would win some popular support but would not tamper with the existing class structure, a government strong enough to serve the growing needs of an entrepreneurial class while withstanding the democratic egalitarian demands of the popular class. I think that's very well spoken, because I think that the notion that we can escape the class we're born into is much overplayed. I think it's much harder to, especially in this economy today, if you're born into the middle class, you're pretty much going to stay in the middle class. I mean, my in-laws in England, I mean, when I've gone over to England and talked about this matter with them, it's almost sacrosanct that the class you're born into in Europe, especially in England, especially in the UK, is the class you stay in. If you're working class, you're going to stay working class. You know, if you're a street sweeper, you're going to die a street sweeper. And it seems to be becoming more and more the rule in this country more than the exception. Not that it ever was the rule, but any notion that you could have escaped that I think, has flown out the window more than ever before.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I mean, we go back to perhaps what – can we believe that Lincoln was really, you know, from his bootstraps up? Yeah, probably. And maybe that went on for a while through the 19th century. But, yeah, I mean, I would think especially when the Rockefellers took over and the rest of the robber barons, what was ensconced here were people that were in the bloodline and were going to stay that way.
Sure. And I think people also need to understand that, you know, when we talk about these things, you know, the things of today versus the things of yesterday, it's, to me, it's pretty much one long corridor. It's human nature being the same, the flesh being subject to the same temptations, and the fact that at the Constitutional Convention, there were no poor farmers, there were no artisans or indentured servants or slaves attending the convention to offer an opposing viewpoint. I mean, if you're an ordinary working stiff, it's going to be pretty tough to take 4 months off to go to Philly and write a constitution. So the debate between the haves and have-nots never took place.
No, it never did. Absolutely right. And it was never meant to, by the way.
Right.
You let the elites go down there and tell everybody what they did was create an everyman document. Yeah, kiss my purple butt. I mean, but it's true. It's, oh, because you said so? Thank you. Okay, we're fine. Put it in history books. We'll all be okay.
Yeah, and in a future show, I'd love to discuss what I'll just briefly divert to the Hologram of Liberty by Kenneth Royce, the second edition, which is expanded from the first. And there is a chapter in Hologram that's called Hamilton, Covert Bankster Agent. It's a short chapter, mm-hmm. but it's very interesting, and I'd like to get into it perhaps in a future installment. Mr. Royce sort of had sentiments not unlike yours and mine and Theo's and some other folks who are tired of the patriotards and the Patriots, that was it. That he really kind of saw the futility. And he has a quote in here from Mike Wasden, "I'm taking the blue pill." Okay. And he says, "At this point in time, the people don't want freedom. I'm just tired of yelling fire with no one listening. And besides, I need to look out for my best interests for a while. I have let the government become the focal point of my life, and it has almost destroyed me." And this is when Kenneth, he says, and I'll quote here, "I've been doing this for 2 decades come November and wanted to diversify elsewhere since 2004. Presently, I have nothing more to offer on the general subject of liberty and would question its efficacy even if I did. I tried my best, but am now avoiding as I can the totalitarian juggernaut cheered on by the lazy and clueless. It has finally become time for me to move on while I have some youth remaining and reclaim my former life for family and travel. And as I do so, I would appreciate your understanding, prayers, and kind wishes." Now, how familiar does that sound? How often can you bang your head against the wall trying to penetrate some of these cement-headed skulls that send the Kill the Raghead for Christ emails that I'm still getting, mm-hmm. and I still bang on them, and I think that they've just cut me out of their loop. I don't want to fantasize that I've changed any minds, but they've probably just cut me out of the loop.
And you'll probably be in one of the detention camps near your home.
Yes. Hey, maybe if I rat out my neighbor, I can get an extra pair of quilted pajamas.
That's it. Or a bowl of rice. You never can tell.
A bowl of rice. Yep.
All your favorite podcasters and writers will be in there, too, though.
Oh,
I'm sure they will, Theo.
I'm only asking that I can work in a garden. That's all I mean. I just want to work in a garden.
You know that. Yeah.
But, we laugh about this, but, there's a somewhat sick feeling I get in my stomach when I see the attitude of people in America, which is getting become more and more, you know, America, love it or leave it, here we go again. you know, and with the reaction in the wake of the Boston bombing, which we've been through this, it's horrible, I understand it, but with the show of force and just loving it, I'm like, oh, man, I tell you what. You know, like it says in that song, Fortunate Son, you know, ooh, you know, when they point the cannon at you.
Some folks are born, made to wave the flag, cool their red, white, and blue. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, cool, they point the cannon at you.
Yep, and of course, there we have the whole scene from A Man for All Seasons. It never gets old because
it never
to me
does.
It's a timeless meme.
But that, you know, they don't care. I mean, when the less you think, the easier it is to just instill some kind of meme in people, and they'll just run with it. And so if you know, like for instance, what I went through today, how dare I say it? Then it comes into this patriot thing. It's like, you know, take that patriot thing and shove it, all right? Don't give me that kind of crap. No, I don't love my country. I don't love anything that's a corporation. You know, stop it. You know, I pay my taxes. I'm a law-abiding citizen. But don't tell me I got to go in for this other garbage. But that's what we're coming to. And holy mackerel, man, we have the next domestic terrorist event. Oh, that'll be the end of it all.
It's just a matter of time.
Without a doubt. But, I mean, you know, it was foretold, and we're being worked like Nazi Germany was being worked, you know, somewhat almost 100 years ago. And it never fails. The formula is always good.
Well, sure, and then you look back at the founding fraudsters, I like to call them that. They believe that the states acted with insufficient force against popular uprisings. So Congress, they were given the task of organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, which basically is another word for standing army, and they called it forth to, quote, suppress insurrections, unquote. So they were empowered to protect the states against this domestic violence. So you have a provision for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, and for the maintenance of an army and navy for both national defense and to establish an armed federal presence within the potentially insurrectionary states. Now, here's a very important point that Parenti makes. A measure that was to prove a godsend to the industrial barons a century later when the U.S. Army was used repeatedly to break strikes by miners and railroad and factory workers. Bang on. Bingo.
Yep.
That's exactly what happened.
Gus Myers covers it again. Yep. Same book. The Supreme Court history.
Well,
wow.
Are you talking also about the strikes that went into, the early 20th century?
Yeah, but in the 1800s as well.
As well,
the late
sure.
1800s, yeah.
Well, here's a good story for you. A guy I went to college with in 68 had driven with his parents and his older brother to bring him out to school. And so they take him out. I forget where he was. But in any rate, they could not turn around and come back in the same day. So they get a motel, and my friend goes into his room, and he turns on the TV. Now, this is the summer of 68, okay? And he's watching this head splitting going on, and he's thinking, holy crap. Look what they're doing in Czechoslovakia, because if you remember, the Russians moved in on Czechoslovakia in 68.
That's right.
And he's sitting there watching, and he realized, no, it's Chicago. It's the Democratic Convention.
Oh, my God.
You remember that? Holy crap, yes. Did heads roll in that joint. So, I mean, here you go. Oh, no, it's America. Oh, is it really? Okay. You know, for a while there, I didn't know. But, of course, that only happens in other countries, not here.
Yeah, and here we have the propertyless majority. And again, you have Madison pointing out in Federalist Number 10, must not be allowed to concert in common cause against the propertied class and its established social order.
So
and even Washington talked about it in his farewell address. I don't think I've got the quote in front of me, but he talked about obeying the government. Maybe I can find it.
While you're doing that, then you're saying I guess what you're saying is that these individuals who, of course, are equated with our wonderful liberty, in a sense, were kind of saying, let them stay peasants. We want them
to stay peasants. Let them eat cake. That's right.
Okay.
And Stoughton Lind, he was an interesting author that noted, you know, the Constitution was the settlement of a revolution. What was at stake for Hamilton, Livingston, and their opponents was more than speculative windfalls and securities. It was the question, what kind of society would emerge from the revolution when dust had settled, and on which class the political center of gravity would come to rest. Their motives were no higher than those of any other social group struggling for place and power in the U.S. of 1787, the founding fraudsters. But possessing more time, money, information, and organization, they enjoyed superior results. Once again, it's about the money. I mean, Madison, for example, his notes, which recorded most of the actual deliberations, and I do have a source now for the convention notes that were dictated, the proceedings. It's something like 3 or 4 volumes, and I do have a link to that. Pretty large files, but it's all laid out, or at least the vast majority of it. At his insistence, only after all the participants were dead, 53 years later, that's when they were published, the notes from the convention.
That's like the Kennedy files.
Weren't they supposed to be released, and then they postponed the releasing again by 50 or 100 years?
Yeah.
For the Kennedy files?
What a surprise. Yeah, well, you know, Lee Harvey did it. What's the big deal?
And I'm sure we'll hear plenty of talk show hosts, I'm not going to mention any names, talking about how, you know, Kennedy was taken out by a lone commie.
In fact, 2 nights ago, I believe, one of the History Channels had a show on called America's Book of Secrets or something like that, or I don't know. And they got into assassinations. It was the biggest nothing I've ever seen.
Yeah. I can't watch a minute of those type of shows anymore.
The only thing I found interesting, though, was that they did show a number of newspapers that had published stories that the assassination of McKinley was a much larger conspiracy that was supposedly supported by Italian anarchists. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it was Czolgosz that shot McKinley. And I know I went back and looked in some of the old papers, and the Secret Service was being dressed down for how in the world could a guy come up with his hand wrapped in a handkerchief and you not grab him before he got to McKinley? Are you serious? Yeah, great. Oh, the guy's got his hand in a handkerchief. No problem. Go ahead.
You think Italian, you think there's a Romanist connection?
You know,
I wonder how many winks and nods were in that line.
Well, we're gonna look all into this very shortly, because the assassination of McKinley, if you believe that there aren't lone gunmen, that they get whacked for transgressions, one of which is usually not going with the program or being at least somewhat obstinate, then you have to figure out what the program was or what he wasn't going to do. That's the big thing about McKinley, and certainly it was a number of very important issues at that time. And remember, one of them was whether they went mono or bimetal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We all think that bimetalism is a good thing, and I would have to say it is, because if they go ahead and play games with gold, you have silver as a hedge. But the question was the Eastern bankers, and that's why you had the whole story, too, about the Wizard of Oz, the Yellow Brick Road. They wanted just gold because they could play with gold and there'd be no hedge against it. So
wasn't there supposed to be a certain ratio between gold and silver, like 16 to 1?
Oh, yeah, there were.
Gone out the window.
Yep.
Now.
Yeah. No, well, historically, it should snap back. It always has before.
Oh, but by the way, if we had any idea that gold and silver were being suppressed, and of course they are, our man in Northern Ireland, Liam, sent across, I don't know if you saw this, that they're going to try to, like, lay suits against some outfit in England for deliberately suppressing the price of, as they would say there, aluminium.
Aluminium.
So they're dicking with the price of aluminum, and it's like, well, I mean, I've never seen it such that they've suppressed gold and silver now. So, yeah, I mean, they can do whatever they want to, but at the time of McKinley, when they still wanted hard money backing the current, you know, the paper currency, you had most people going for bimetallism because they wanted to stop any kind of manipulation of gold. And so it really didn't work. But this is, again, with the Wizard of Oz, that's one of the allegorical layers where the Westerners wanted silver in there because they were mining silver like crazy in Nevada and other places. And, of course, the East just wanted gold. So
that movie was so rife with symbolism and so many layers of allegory. It's amazing.
It is. I mean, in the old days, I think I found four. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, there was an occult level to it because of theosophy and all this other jazz.
Apparently, even the story is even more symbolic.
How so, Theo?
Well, I'm just remembering the one or two interviews. No, it was more than one. Interviews you did, Al, a couple of different internet writers about that.
Yeah,
that's fascinating
true.
Stuff.
Yeah, it is true. So, good old Frank Baum.
Yep.
And I had a laugh because on the original book cover for The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, I think that's the full name. Do you remember the depiction of the lion?
Yes.
It was the griffin from England.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I mean, so you had the Tin Man, and you had, what was it, the Straw Man.
Straw Man.
Yeah. And you had, what's-her-face, Dorothy, and the lion.
The ruby slippers.
And actually, those ruby slippers in the book are silver.
They are. That's correct.
So there's your silver versus gold. Silver slippers.
Even the name Toto was symbolic. The dog.
What,
I forget now what it was, but.
Oh, that would it would become a musical group later on?
Yeah, no.
Well, Toto means all, right? I mean, in Latin.
Yeah, okay, that was it.
All
right.
In Toto, yes.
So, the ruby slippers were silver. The reason they said they made them ruby or red in the movie, because the movie was color, and red obviously showed better than silver, and I can believe that. But the silver slippers on the golden brick road, there's your silver and gold.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the other thing that cracks me up is, like, the Emerald City. There's a bunch of them in the United States, but the two I think that are foremost is Dallas and Seattle. And then that whole thing came into play with Kennedy's assassination in the one Emerald City, which is Dallas.
And interesting, too, how the oil was so important in the story. Oil played a very important role in the story as well.
I remember it got the Tin Man going again.
That's right. Black gold, Texas tea.
Yeah, move out of there, Jed.
The Straw Man, too.
What?
Yes.
Straw Man represents our fictitious entity that's been created for us.
In all capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was, well, it's also supposed to be the farmer, isn't it? And the Tin Man was supposed to be industry?
I think so.
Yep. Okay.
He didn't have a heart.
There you go.
And you mentioned the Oz, right, for ounce. I think you mentioned.
There you go, Oz, that's right.
Oh.
Anyway, that was fascinating. But you see, that was also at the same time McKinley. So going back to what you had mentioned before, Eric, about... Was it Theo, about the Romanist element in the assassination of McKinley? I had not thought about that.
That was Theo. Yeah, Theo mentioned that.
Sorry, Theo. I didn't. In fact, when they showed in the Hour documentary, the newspaper, I didn't get a chance to glance at the headlines, but it did say that. I did not pick that up in some of the papers I looked at. And I want to say once again that there's an excellent website called chroniclingamerica.loc.gov.
That's a superb source.
Holy mackerel. You're not going to get the really big newspapers because they keep their own archives to this day, but you'll find some good ones like the New York Tribune and some other ones in Washington. And you'll find accounts, usually not the same day because, let's face it, it was newspapers. It was the day after. But the one I saw was, of course, the one that criticized the Secret Service for not stopping the guy. You know, with a handkerchief around his hand. Are you serious? And the other one was that they also knew there was somebody who sold him the gun. And they knew there was some kind of conspiracy, but I never saw anything to that point that indicated that there was a supposed vast Italian plot, Italian anarchist plot.
I don't know if there was a British sort of British version of Mata Hari who was involved in that plot as well. It was either McKinley or who was the other one? Harrison? McKinley was shot, though. I do believe it might have been I can't remember her name, but there was a British gal involved somehow.
That sounds vaguely
familiar.
That sounds vaguely familiar. I'm going to have to check it out. Kira did a bunch of stuff with McKinley and is still doing it.
She did some good homework on that.
Shogosh, yeah, was the assassin of McKinley. Gateau was the assassin of Garfield. And I do remember there seems to be something involved in there, but we're going to have to take a look. Yeah, that's what we were laughing about. I mean, laughing, but...
You mean the lone nut assassins, right?
Well, I mean, you got three assassinations in 26 years. I mean, this is civilized politics? I mean, what percentage of lone gunmen being successful do we have? And what are the odds for that, really? You know,
well, that's a good question. It's just like this Fort Hood shooter. There were eyewitnesses. I mean, I don't mean to go far afield here, and believe me, I don't, but very brief mention. Eyewitnesses say 2-3 shooters. You know, there again, you know, and what have all the official reports said? Lone gunman, single shooter, period, end of story. Let's just move on and fade away.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, you hear this, with all the assassinations, it's a lone gunman, and then you find out there's like 3 different caliber bullets in the area. I mean, even when they try to kill Wallace in Laurel, Maryland, and it didn't work, they found 3 different caliber bullets, and they just let the whole story go, you know, fade away. So
now, wasn't he crippled after that?
Yeah, he was wheelchaired after that.
Okay, he was paraplegic, yeah.
Yeah. So, and he had a change of heart, too, and I think that was real. But no matter, you know, we had a guy, Bremer. And also, since the two of you have said okay to doing a roundtable about assassinations and their perpetrators, you'll find, Theo, with Teddy Roosevelt, that the character that was stalking him is very reminiscent of Bremer later on. So
I hate to admit this, but I wasn't even aware until recent times that Teddy Roosevelt, that they took a shot at him.
Yeah, but not as a president when he was a third-party candidate who was doing extremely well.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think he was entered into the race, obviously, so that Wilson would win it. And I'm just wondering why he was popped. Was it really a lone gunman, or was there something else to it?
How did I miss that one in history? Wow.
Yeah, and it really truly is that he had his folded-up speech in his pocket. And it was tripled up, and it was in his pocket, and it did decelerate the bullet so that it didn't kill him.
So that's a case like the 2 times the Rockefellers tried to off Ford and the guns misfired?
Well, you know, you hire cheap help, this is what you're going to get.
Jackson, too.
Uh-oh.
The 2 flintlock pistols.
I know.
And I've got some experience with flintlocks, and I'll tell you, they can be very, very tricky.
Well, I mean, I know, but you're right. But the guy should have had, like, at least a knife or something else or... But
yeah, because Jackson had his cane.
Ooh.
and that Chase, there is... I'm sorry, go ahead, Theo.
Chased the guy down with his cane after the pistols misfired.
But that's
good
great.
Old,
I mean, wouldn't you like to have been there right after the second click? Oops.
Oh, yeah. Feet don't fail me now.
Yeah, a Freddie Flintstone at Dabba Dabba right out of there. Ooh, you know you're not having a good day when.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, this is what we're talking about, though. This is American politics, you know.
There is some truth to the story, in my days of Masonic participation, where rumors of say, Israel Putnam, who was from upstate Connecticut, who was a leader during the Revolution, there were stories of one leader on the British side who was a Mason, one leader on the American side who was a Mason, would basically say, look, we really don't have to do this. You're a brother, I'm a brother, you know, and I'm sure there's enough brothers smattered throughout our troops. Why don't you go on that side of the hedgerow, and I'll go on this side of the hedgerow, and we'll just pretend we never saw each other.
So what I said to JQ then in an interview is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's just a lack of a lot of battles. And, I mean, usually in the wintertime they just said, the heck with it. You know,
during rain time, too. If it was raining, a lot of times they would say, well, let's just call the battle off till tomorrow. Sometimes tomorrow never came, especially if the 2 leaders were Masons.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it makes sense to me.
Many times after lodge, we would talk about that downstairs, you know, and there would be often discussions, and sometimes documentation would accompany the discussions.
All right, so then it was accepted by Masonry that this may have taken place during the American Revolution, and it was fair dinkum.
Yes.
Okay, I can.
You know what? I see a red flag in this, right, along those same lines. When the French Admiral de Grasse came and bottled up the British at Yorktown, that's a red flag to me, because I see some Masonic deals going on there. Because, number one, name another time in history when the French beat the British at anything, especially naval.
What was that old saying about the French? Invisible in war, invincible in peace.
But and number two, notice how when they slid in there and bottlenecked, Cornwallis, notice there was no bloodshed, too.
Well, that's a good point then. So what you're saying is that would be even carried out further if you have a French masonry element in it as well, right?
The British Masons and the French Masons
and the
got
American.
Together. I would bet money on it, yeah.
All right, one thing I have to tell you, and I think you'll enjoy this, but you were talking about how many times the French ever beat the British, but there's a book by the late Barbara Tuchman called A Distant Mirror. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but she does
read
a
it,
book.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I have not. I'd like to, though.
Well, she focuses the book on a middle-level noble, I think by the name of de Cussy. But the stories that are in there, she does not write them for humor, but they're funny in themselves. I mean, there really truly was a Black Knight and stuff like that. But one of this, and Theo, do you remember this? The French and the Brits, I mean, I don't know when this is, like maybe the 14th or 13th century. They're like, look, we don't have to go to war. Why don't we just take the 100 best combatants from each force and we'll just go at it.
And the
French
I don't remember the battle.
You remember the French are like, yeah, okay. So those are the rules, just 100 against 100. And I think the French were in England. I think this took place in England. So they're okay. So they send their 100 out, and all of a sudden over the ridge comes riding like 1,000 cavalry.
Yeah. Yep.
The French
are
like,
sacré
bleu.
I don't know how the French would say habada, habada, habada.
Yeah, I know. So I'm like, you know, and then, you know, when I think of that, you look back at the really golden years of Monty Python, and you can see where they got some of this humor. I mean, can't you, you know? Holy mackerel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's like the joke about how can you tell he's a peasant?
Yeah, he's got shit on him.
That's right.
Yep.
So, I mean, so she had that in the book. And the other thing real quick I want to tell you about. And if you get a chance to read, get that book. I mean, it's just worth it. It was amazing. But she was also talking about the guy who had to like joust with the Black Knight. You know, he said something, I forget what it was, but he had to. The guy was so scared, he shook so badly that they put him up on his saddle and he fell off the horse on the other side. and eventually the Black Knight came up and was like, "Get out of here, you jerk!" You know, so. just great stories. That was a great book by Tuchman. All right, listen.
Huh? Something. It's you don't see too many women who are really interested in history. Kira is one of them. I wish that you'd see it more often, but Tuchman was brilliant.
Hey, well, Joan Mellon.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kira. So.
Yep.
That's it. All right, we got about 15 minutes left, so with that in mind, Eric, please direct we wayward souls back to the focus point here.
Sure thing. The Whiskey Rebellion of 1794, which was a democratic working-class insurrection, I found a superbly researched treatise by a Wythe Holt, and I will send you this link. W-Y-T-H-E, Holt. And I believe that it's an Australian author, and this is extracted from a book. It's probably about, I don't know, I've read about maybe half of it, but just what I've read is just chock full. It's so well footnoted, and it's gotten to the point where this thing is completely dog-eared. And they've got testimonies and letters. For example, there was a letter that Hamilton wrote to his sister saying that he wanted to stoke the rebellion.
Hmm.
Almost getting into the Hegelian dialectic,
mm-hmm.
where there were four counties in Pennsylvania where this was concentrated. And the official story is that it was because of the excise tax on whiskey. But in reading this, I'm really coming to the conclusion that there was a lot more to it. And this treatise, he goes into some of these lesser known and forgotten aspects of history, where he concentrates more on the gripes and the grievances of the working class. What historians have come to call the Whiskey Rebellion was an armed uprising against the U.S. government in the latter half of 1794, which took place primarily in and around Pittsburgh in southwestern Pennsylvania. The executive raised more than 12,000 militia troops and sent them hundreds of miles across the Appalachian Mountains, an army as large as any the U.S. put in the field during the Revolution. Now, there was, this was Whiteholt's coercion by law. The Federal Whiskey Rebellion cases take working class insurrection to court, 1795, Australian JL and SOC Harriet forthcoming. So I take it this was a work in progress. Hamilton, he took effective command and stayed with the expeditionary force throughout its operation. And as I mentioned earlier, it seemed like they wanted to take the judiciary along with the executive. Washington and Hamilton went along with this expedition. And I'm getting the feeling that the people of the country, particularly the western inhabitants, saw the problem of lawyers. And I ask, and like I said, I need to do a lot more research on this to see if there's anything to my theory here, in quotes, if that was sort of the inspiration to the original 13th Amendment.
Don't forget, some of that was residual. Remember, when the Pilgrims landed, that the first century, about the first 100 years of the British colonies, lawyers were outlawed. Don't forget that part.
That's right. I do believe I recall the informer talking about in the 1600s, practicing law in Virginia was a hanging offense.
Yep.
Jeez. Let me ask you, are you saying that Washington and Hamilton rode out during the Whiskey Rebellion?
Yes. They did accompany the troops. That's what I got here.
So we have the president and the secretary of the treasury riding out with the troops.
Riding out with the troops.
And what was that supposed to
be? The powerful secretary of the treasury, Alexander Hamilton, then took effective command and stayed with the expeditionary force throughout its operations. And there is an element here where Washington actually confronted some poor farmers. Basically, I don't know if they were squatters, but he told them, in essence, to get off his land. They offered to purchase it from him, and he told them to pound sand. And he says, I own this land as surely as I own my handkerchief. And he stormed out. So where's all this passion and compassion for the huddled masses yearning to be free? Washington was basically a speculative douchebag who has been given a far greater status in history than I think he deserves.
Well,
as far as Hamilton is concerned, I think he makes Benedict Arnold look like a petty traitor.
Remember, Washington was arguably the richest man in America at that time, so you can buy a lot of publicity with that.
Yes. Here's another excerpt. The rebellion seemed to melt away before the huge army, offering not a single musket shot at the troops. And I'll interject here, there was a lot of duplicity practiced by Washington and Hamilton. The troops or the rebels were told that if they were to surrender, they'd be given amnesty. No such thing happened. They were interrogated pulled out of their homes. Families were humiliated and injured, not unlike what we saw in Boston earlier this year. The government enacted violent, brutal reprisals nevertheless, brought back and tried a bedraggled group of captive rebels, then proceeded to downplay the episode in a manner echoed by most historians since 1795. Gee, no. No, couldn't be. Mainstream historians have either forgotten it or have recalled it in a nostalgic and sanitized fashion. The most recent installment of this latter genre is Thomas P. Slaughter's The Whiskey Rebellion. And that's supposedly sort of the Wikipedia version of the event.
Yeah.
And the more I look at Wikipedia, the more pissed off I get.
Yeah, that's why
I'm not going to send those idiots one plug nickel of my money.
No. No, and don't think that they're not subsidized. You know, and this poor little, oh, please contribute because we're just, yeah, bullshit.
Anything mainstream, it's vanilla. A few years back, I was on vacation, and I wanted to find a book to read, and unfortunately, the only game in town was a Barnes & Noble where I was at. So I had to go, and I picked out a history book in Barnes & Noble, and it's all the only game in town. So I got a book about Boss Tweed by Kenneth Ackerman, I think it was. And sure enough, it was a vanilla fluff piece. And I learned some things. I wanted to learn more about the Tammany Hall and Boss Tweed thing, but it was ridiculous. When Boss Tweed started getting into trouble, The big banker at the time was Astor. Was it John Jacob Astor? I don't know which one. Astor. And according to this mainstream historian author, Astor and the other bankers were in fear of this Boss Tweed guy, and they were telling Boss, you know, don't commit this crime. This is horrible. Please stop. It was almost that bad. And yet, when it came time for Boss Tweed to be removed and sent to jail, who was on the committee to decide that, but John Jacob Astor. There's no connection made as to who is the real power there with mainstream historians.
Yeah,
WWF.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
You know, and he talks here, too. It says, the rebellion. You know, speaking of this, and you've got the haves and the have-nots. The rebellion deserves much greater modern attention. The large bulk of the rebels, the working-class folk of their time, opposed both the United States under the Constitution of 1789 and the new government formed pursuant thereto because they thought both were elitist and unresponsive to their needs. So there was a lot more to this than just the excise tax on whiskey. The sanitized versions of history only talk about that, but there was far more to the Whiskey Rebellion than meets the eye and that we have been told, and I would definitely like to get into this more in future installments, if that's okay.
Yeah, definitely, next time around, if you could.
I think, Eric, some people confuse Shay's Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion.
Right. Well, the Whiskey Rebellion occurred in 1794 in Pennsylvania. Shay's Rebellion occurred, I believe, was 1787 in Massachusetts.
I got it right here. Yeah, well, I sent you both a link to an article that comes out of, I believe, Springfield College.
That looked good, just browsing, cursorily browsing through it.
You both have it, so I'm looking. I mean, I'm only scanning it to get, like, when they figure, you know, this all happened, but it looks like 1782?
Oh, for Shay's
Rebellion? Oh, no, during the fall of 1786. Okay, that's when it is.
Okay.
That's when they started getting a little uptight.
Okay. The elites were very afraid of that, you know, of Shay's Rebellion. Most of all, the provincials found the Federalist governmental structure and Hamilton's economic policies to be a violation of the democratic promise of the American Revolution to which they had offered their blood, farms, time, and treasure. And what was that we had talked about at one point, Al, about the guy who fights in Brandywine all of a sudden finds himself with the Constitution and these hucksters, these founding lawyers going down to Philadelphia and saying, oh, we're just going to tweak the articles. And what do? They throw them in the fire.
In secret.
In secret. That's right.
And that's all we're saying here, and that is, okay, fine. You wanted to bring the Constitution in? Tell the people you're doing it. And you're not even elected officials to go ahead and do this, but tell them you're doing it. And that's all we're saying. And
they never would have accomplished it because the only state that actually voted on the Constitution was Little Rhode Island, and they rejected the thing 11-1. And these elites knew that, and there was no way they were going to tell the unwashed hoi polloi that this is what we wanted to do. Because
they
basically would have...
Fargo.
All right, now, remember we've talked also about privileges and rights and how really we have no rights, we have privileges. And it does say in the Constitution that habeas corpus is a privilege, and you remember the story that blah, 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 except that shall not be, whatever the wording is, shall not be repealed or whatever or denied, except when this happens and this happens, right? The old except clause. Well, in the story about Shay's Rebellion, it says in late October, and they're talking about the year, 1786. All right, so in October 1786, one of the things that, okay, here we are. The state cracked down on the regulation issuing the Militia Act and the Riot Act. In addition, the legislature soon suspended the writ of habeas corpus. So,
there we go.
It's, you know, and I got into this thing with those sovereign citizen types, and we said, look, you know, I understand. They have good intentions. But I said to them, you don't understand. You don't have any rights. You have privileges. And I said, take a look at the Constitution. I mean, it says in it that you don't have the right of habeas corpus. It's a privilege that can be rescinded. And since we are, and I think you will all agree, we have been classed as rebels in the eyes of the government. And apparently this goes back to 1933 and the Banking Act.
Yep.
So because the guy said to me, he goes, well, the judges have to uphold the Constitution. I'm like, right, Junior, but understand something. The Constitution has classified us as rebels in the 14th Amendment. I mean, as it states in the 14th Amendment, brought on by our new description as was incepted in 1933 with the Banking Act. We're considered enemies of the state. We're considered rebels. And so the judges are doing exactly what they're doing. They're upholding the Constitution, which doesn't uphold our rights.
And it goes all the way back to the start. When Hamilton and Washington confronted the rebels, there was no, and this was in 1794, supposedly after the Constitution was ratified and signed and everything else, here are the two major players in this whole thing. They certainly didn't offer these rebels any kind of rights, you know, no Bill of Rights, no constitutional protections or clauses. They practiced many different kinds of dissembling and real rotten tactics. And the next phantasms, I'd like to get more of this into more of this. And there's some fascinating history here that I was never taught in school. And just this is incredible. This article, this treatise is probably the finest treatise I've ever come across as far as cross-references, footnotes, sources, attributions, and the like.
Do I have it right, though, too? And we're going to get out of here now, and we're going to hold you to that, and by all means do that, and let's get down to the meat. But I would assume that at the time they had, by the time of Shay's Rebellion, they still didn't have the Constitution yet, right? The Constitution didn't actually take hold until what? Maybe, what, 1787 it was adopted?
1789, if I remember. Yeah. It was 1789, and this Shay's Rebellion was like 2 years prior. And that was one of the reasons that these elites wanted to get this done, because they saw the handwriting on the wall. They saw the tumult and chaos that was being fomented just by, you know, and this was around the same time the anti-federalists were starting to write. And the people were starting to realize that these elites, they're going to start to pull some fast ones, and we better get wise to it. And I think that's one of the reasons that they really they put the pedal to the metal, to use the old cliche, and wanted to button this thing up as soon as they could.
JQ also in his series comes at it from the side of the elites, more or less, that were looking at what was happening as, you know, basically rogues and ruffians trying to just run wild. But it was clear that they realized that this country really isn't necessarily all that stable right now. And I think correctly so. They saw that, and they wanted to put an end to any kind of trouble, which, honestly, you can't blame the hoi polloi for creating, considering they knew they were getting waxed.
Well, and yeah, and in 1794, the dirty little secret is that the country was extremely unstable, and there were two major Indian massacres along the Ohio River that I'd like to mention next time that probably haven't been discussed too much in history either.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for the time you spent with us, Eric, Theo also, and we'll reconvene hopefully in 2 weeks.
It's always fun. Thanks, Al. Thanks, Theo.